So, well, I'm going to, well, present you some work on the model of in vitro vascular genesis, and also some show you how some of the results can also be translated to angiogenesis, to the formation of sprouts from cell clones. So, first of all, it has been introduced quite a few times already, but I also would like to kind of explain to you what I mean by when I say vascular genesis. So vascular genesis is kind of the initial event of blood vessel formation in the embryo, where endothelial cells organize, differentiate from, differentiate and then organize into vascular networks. And this primary vascular plexus will then associate with additional cell types and further develop into the vascular system by sprouting, by the production of additional vessels through angiogenesis. And so, just to show you some examples, this is in the early mouse yolk sac, where you see these nice vascular patterns. And this is in the chick, where you also see these the formation of these vascular cores of different sizes throughout the embryo. And so this primitive network will then expand and associate with additional cell types through angiogenesis. And angiogenesis involves a number of different processes. And one of them is the sprouting of new blood vessels from parent vessels. But also new vessels can form by bridging and by interception of existing vessels, which leads to daughter vessels. So the initiation of angiogenesis involves a number of steps. First you have a destabilization of the blood vessel, so the blood vessel can dilate, and the basal lamina will be degraded by proteolytic enzymes, and then endothelial cells will start proliferating and migrating. These endothelial cells will then organize into cords, and then the last step of that is the formation of a lumen. I will only concentrate during this talk on the migration of endothelial cells, so the formation of cords by the migration of endothelial cells. Oops. All right, so why would we want to do that? Why would we want to build a model of blood vessel growth? Well, of course we would like to develop and test hypothetical methods. So what we would like to do is to get insight into what an endothelial cell needs to do in order to make these vascular networks. And in this way, we might be able to kind of distinguish the intrinsic patterning ability of individual endothelial cells and additional mechanisms that are going to steer this, steer the formation of these networks and going to attract blood vessels to remote locations. So, and also, one thing we would like to do is to understand the interplay between genetically regulated events in morphogenesis and biophysical patterning mechanisms. So how do these two interact? And another question is also whether angiogenesis and vasculogenesis are really two separate mechanisms, or whether they might be two sides of the same coin. So maybe the same repertoire of endothelial cell behaviors might be responsible for both processes. Based on these models, we would like to suggest experimental tests to validate or falsify these hypothetical mechanisms. And in this way, modeling will become part of the empirical cycle. So traditionally, biologists would make a hypothesis and then design an experiment to test the hypothesis. What you can do with modeling is to replace this kind of conceptual back of the envelope models by computational models, where you can, before devising an experimental test, you can really test whether the hypothetical mechanism will work, will actually do what you think it does. And that is, I think, a really useful addition to experimental research. Okay, so between the intrinsic patterning abilities of the endothelial cells and other additional factors, we would like to simplify the system and start studying first an in vitro system. And a very widely used in vitro endothelial cell system is the human umbilical vein endothelial cell in Metrogel system, which has been earlier introduced yesterday by Daphne Mamasaki. So what you see here is a petri dish or a small well. This is about, well, a few millimeters across, where you have a gel, Metrogel, which is an endothelial cell matrix, is an extracellular matrix, a protein product, which is obtained from mouse tumors. And in these, on top of this gel, you can see it, endothelial cells that are obtained from umbilical cords. And if you do so, the cells, the endothelial cells stimulated by the, are stimulated by the growth factors that are in the gel and in the ECM, and will elongate and organize into a vascular pattern. And this is a movie that I got from Luigi Preziosi, whose work I will introduce later in this talk, which is from an experimental collaborator. So what you see here is these endothelial cells that are elongating and moving towards each other and organizing into a nice vascular pattern. And also what I would like you to notice is that you see a kind of typical coarsening behavior. So initially you see a very fine-grained pattern, then small gaps, which are typically lacunae, these spaces around here, will contract. While the typical size of the lacunae will grow in size over time. And later on, I will try to characterize that that coarsening behavior.
What's the time scale for these
patterns? It's about 24 hours. Yeah.
And did they end up with tubules?
Well, yeah. Finally, I'm not really sure, but I think finally the cells roll up and form tubules, but I'm not really sure.
Sort of not the greatest thing to do. You can't pump anything through them.
I'm sorry?
You can't pump anything through there like a microfluidic device.
I wouldn't be sure, but I don't think so. Yeah.
How do we initiate this? How do we begin?
So they just have this gel, and they seed endothelial cells on top of it. So these are endothelial cells from culture bottles. They're kind of rounded up. They're put in culture, and then they start elongating and organizing into these vascular networks. And just to have a detailed view of that, a close-up, where you can really see the individual endothelial cells. Well, you see here how they are elongating and organizing into vascular.
I might point out that some of those round birefringent cells at the beginning are mitosing cells.
That's possible, yeah.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
I mean, not now. But now, if it's a round cell, it's probably
over here?
Mitosis. Yeah.
Over there, yeah. But well, there's certainly some mitosis going on, but over the time scale of the patterning event, it's certainly not a lot of mitosis. Okay, as Daphne Mamasaki has explained to you yesterday, there are several hypotheses, and one of them of how this process works, and one of them could be mechanical hypothesis, where cells are kind of pulling each other, kind of exerting strain on the ECM, and by that pulling other cells towards them. Another hypothesis that has been introduced by Gamma and Cerini and Viziosi is that cells actually secrete a chemoattractant, which will attract other cells. And to explain to you what is chemoattractant, we're every day doing it when we're trying to find a cup of coffee. You can smell the coffee and you're walking towards higher concentrations of that
stuff. We're not secreting coffee.
We're not secreting coffee, that's true.
No, somebody might be secreting perfume, and you might be.
It might be a pheromone,
yeah.
It might be an iron.
But you're saying that cells secrete something and then it also smells something from somewhere else. You've already got a halo of stuff around it.
Yeah.
You're not secreting coffee when you're smelling coffee. And you've already got a concentration around it.
Well, the concentration will accumulate. If you have a high concentration of cells, suppose we're all secreting coffee, then if we're close together, then we will have a real big halo and a real concentrated halo of coffee smell around
smell
it.
Your own coffee,
so you can smell
anyone.
But if you're just secreting a little bit of coffee,
a little bit.
Yeah. And you're not smelling it, but if you're together.
Okay.
So that's the idea. Okay? And how they showed that this might be actually going on. What they did, they again took these cell cultures that I just showed you, and then tracked their movement over time. And also what they did is they input all the positions of the cell into a computer simulation and assumed these were sources of a hypothetical cumulative tracking that decays in time. And what you see then is indeed that if you have high concentrations of cells, you get a higher concentration than at positions where there are only few cells. And then what they saw is that the cells are actually moving up these gradients towards high concentrations of this hypothetical cumulative tracking. So this might indeed indicate, although it can also be explained by other things, it might indicate that indeed these cells are attracted by the cumulative tracking, secreted by the cells themselves.
They didn't identify a molecule with that, did they?
No, they didn't. But actually, they said it was VEGF. I don't really believe it, but I have a few reasons for that. But what they did is saturate the cell culture with VEGF and then show that the cell did not no longer accumulate tract. But there are plenty of other reasons why that would happen.
There's maybe just to give the audience a frame of reference, if you did a similar experiment with canine kidney cells, MDCK cells, they behave. The time frames may vary, and you can play games, but they do the same thing.
Okay.
So it isn't about endothelial cells.
Okay. Yeah.
And it certainly isn't about VEGF.
Okay.
Per
yeah.
Se. Per se.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a common thing that cells.
Yeah, it's a common behavior
of
epithelial cells on planar surfaces attached to deformable matrices.
So they developed the following model that you already saw yesterday. And basically the idea is that you have a concentration of cells and you have a field of a velocity field which describes the velocity of the cells, and you have a chemical field. And well, there is a conservation equation which says basically that the cells are moving according to the velocity field. And then you have the cells are chemoattracting. So the velocities the cells are actually accelerated by the chemical gradient, and then the cells are secreting a chemoattractant according to this term, which is degraded in the ECM, and which is diffusing. Okay, so if they run that if they initiate the PDE with a number of Gaussian patches that are with a number of Gaussian patches that look like the cells, you find patterns that look similar to the patterns you see in the cell culture. However, there's one.
I have something with regards to this picture. It seems that the density of cells go down. It seems that a bigger percentage of the picture in the first frame is covered by white spots than in the bigger number range.
what actually is happening is that these cells are. Well, the spots are, it's a continuum model, so the spots are fusing.
Okay.
And I think they have some kind of, I'm not exactly sure, but some kind of threshold function, or maybe some saturation in the gray values. You know, the gray values. So, well, there's actually one strange assumption in there, is that the cells are accelerating. Yes, sorry.
You were just about to address that point.
Well, that's exactly, yeah. It's not realistic. Indeed. Because what these cells are living in a highly viscous medium, and so what happens if you, so they obey what happens if you pull the cells with a certain force, they will first accelerate, of course, but then their velocity is damped by the viscous medium. So what you find is a linear force velocity response. So if you pull the cell, it will move, and as soon as you stop pulling, it will stop moving.
If you were to modify that system of equations, instead of having a form, an equation that says force is proportional to gradient,
right.
You said velocity is proportional to gradient,
right.
Does it exhibit,
no.
The solution still exhibit those behaviors?
No,
those
no, that's the point. That's what I'm going to show. Okay.
Yes.
All right, but before I'm going to show that, I'm actually not going to show it using this set of differential equations, but I'm going to show it using a different kind of model. And the reason for doing is that we really want to incorporate, because this kind of vasculogenesis is not a continuing process. If you look at a blood vessel, you see that it's often just formed by, in cross-section, just by like 3 or 4 or 5 cells. So we really should take the shape and size of the cells into account. So that's why we decided to try and build upon this model using a cell-centered model. And the idea behind it is that if you want to understand how the linear information in the DNA is going to describe the three-dimensional shape of the organism, it's really hard to understand how genetics could directly determine what is happening at the multicellular scale. What genetics can do is maybe change or modify the behavior of individual cells, and then this behavior of individual cells then might be able to result in a three-dimensional pattern. So to understand how genetics is able to drive multicellular patterning, maybe we should try and distinguish two different questions. And the first of those is, how does genetics drive cell behavior? And then how does that cell behavior and interaction with physical laws or physical principles of patterning, how does that cell behavior then drive multicellular patterning? And that is, so the idea behind it is that, okay, cells have only a few behaviors, so they can grow, divide, they can change shape, they can move, and they can move in response to extracellular cues, etc., etc. They can stick to other cells, etc. But and also, of course, they can change their behavior in response to signals from neighboring cells. But if you look at this list of behaviors, it's quite a long list. But if you compare it to all the really the many gene product interactions that are happening in the genetic network, it's not so much. So maybe what a cell is actually doing is a kind of what we need to do in order to understand what is happening in the multicellular organism is really not look at directly at this gene product interaction, but instead try to simplify and look at it from the level of the cell upward to the multicellular scale. The modeling philosophy behind it is that the fundamental entities of our model are cells and generalized cells, for example, mesenchymal cells or endothelial cells in this case, an extracellular matrix, some kind of fluid medium. The cells have an internal state, they might belong to different types. The cell's interaction, we can describe it as an effective energy, which I will explain in more detail later. And additional cell properties are described as constraints, which I will also show later. There would be many possible ways to implement such a modeling philosophy, but we have chosen a particular way that was introduced by James Glaser in 1992. Glaser and Drainer. And that's the cellular pots model. And it's basically a cellular automaton model where cells, as opposed to in traditional cellular automaton, you would describe cells as a state of one CA grid point. But here we are describing the cell several grid points. So what you see here is a square grid with three cells on top of that and an ECM, which is indicated by the white cells around it. Then what we can do is we can describe the state of this system in terms of a Hamiltonian, where first of all we have a cell adhesion terms, which describes the kind of lumps together the cell adhesion between the cells. So, well, for example, over here, we have a number of energy. I'm sorry. I'm okay. Let me just start again. This is a bit confusing. Maybe. So, the cells have bonds to each other, which are these J's, which depend on the cell type and the cell state. Well, I'm really sorry. I don't know what's happening here, but okay. So okay, we have multiple grid sites represent one biological cell. So the cell identity index is sigma, which is the number which is the number that is inside of the cells. So we have a cell adhesion between cells, which is given by these contact energy J, and this depends on the cell's types tau. And then we have this generalized energy H, which is the Hamiltonian, which gives the system state. So okay, the algorithm is as follows: we start picking the random site, then we try then a neighboring cell tries to move its domain into this site. Then we start considering the energy change that would occur if we accepted this coupling. So suppose we have a number of energy. Suppose the cell makes a stronger connection to this cell. Then we would accept it. So if indeed we are going to form a stronger bond, we're going to accept it. But if we would break a strong bond and replace it for a weaker bond, it would lead to energy increase. And we would reject it, and we will repeat this procedure. So, just to show you a little bit what this model is really about. So, in this case, we have two cell types: we have a yellow cell type and a red cell type. And the yellow cells are highly adherent to each other, and the red cells are highly adherent to each other. So then we start iterating this algorithm, where the cells are continuously trying to make new bonds to surrounding cells and to break bonds with surrounding cells. And first I'm showing it really slowly, and now I'm going to move faster in time. Now I'm changing the parameters so that cells, the red cells have a very low adhesion with the surrounding medium. And the yellow cells have a very high adhesion with the medium, so they will, the system can reduce the energy by engulfing the red cell.
Was there any proliferation in these equations?
No, in this case there's no proliferation.
So it's just the same volume of cells.
I'm sorry?
So it's just the same number of cells at the outset as at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but well, it's easy to introduce cell division. And just to show you a number of different behaviors, in this case, well, the initial configuration is a random mixture of yellow and red cells. So if the interaction energy between the yellow cells if the homotypic adhesion is always higher than the heterotypification, which means that the homotypification is always, adhesion energy is lower than heterotypification energy, the cells will sort out. Then we can have cells mix if the cells stick better to the other cell type, and we can get an engulfment if the yellow cells have a very have a very low adhesion to the medium, whereas the red cells will have a very high adhesion to both the yellow cells and the medium, and we can we can have no cell adhesion at all. Okay, but to use this model to model chemotaxis, we also to model vasculogenesis, we also need chemotaxis. And how can we do this? We just add a continuum layer, a PDE layer with chemotractants, and we modify the energy term to also have to bias these continuous extensions of the cells to move up chemical gradients, which means that if a cell tries to expand its domain into a neighboring cell, and it does so up the chemical gradient, well, we will add an energy, extra energy drop, which will favor such a move. The equation for the PDE is as follows. we have secretion by the cells. With secretion by the cells, the chemical degrades outside of the cells, and there is a diffusion term. Okay, so just to summarize the endothelial cell behavior. These are the endothelial cells. We only have one cell type in these simulations. The gray value indicates the concentration of chemotractant, and these concentration isolines also indicate the chemical concentrations. So these endothelial cells continuously probe their environment with the podia. They secrete chemotractants and they move up the chemotractant gradients. Whereas the chemotractant diffuses through the extracellular matrix and rapidly degrades in the extracellular matrix. So just some parameter settings here. We have a cell area of about 100 micrometers squared. The chemicals diffuse relatively slowly. The chemotractant half-life is 30 to 60 minutes, which is based on a value of VEGF. That might be any value discuss it further. We have a time step of about 30 seconds. The grid points indicate are all 2 micrometers at 2 micrometers. And we have set the chemotactic response and the time step such that we obtain mean cell velocity of 5 micrometers per hour, which approximately corresponds to natural cell velocities in cell cultures. Okay. So to come back to your question, so in this case we have indeed a gamma serine model where the inertial term is replaced by a linear force velocity response, and this is what will happen. Indeed, well, it's precisely what you would expect. They start aggregating into blobs, and basically, it seems that the model really breaks down if you no longer have inertia. So, starting from this, our next question was how can we kind of repair this model to still find vascular networks? Should we really dismiss the gamma and serine model, or are there still ways, or are there still additional assumptions we can make to understand the formation of vascular networks? Eventually, it might take exponentially longer, because maybe this one will probably eventually move to that one. Yeah, I think it actually does. But then, of course, the further they go apart, the longer it takes, and the more it depends on the relative drift, but the principle is. So then we've been thinking, what kind of things can you add to this? So then we came across this paper by Gorry Fauré and others, where they found that in vegetarian knockout, which is a very common cell adhesion protein, actually the same kind of blob-like patterns appear in the yolk sac, and also these mice have a lot of defects in angiogenic sprouting. So whereas the wild type has a nice vascular-like network. So we thought, well, maybe it has to do something with cell adhesion. And in the cellular plasma, it was really easy to tune this cell adhesion parameter. Let's just try it. Let's tune the parameters such that the cells are highly adherent to each other. And yes, somehow a vascular-like pattern forms. And also you see this kind of typical behavior where small lacunae disappear over time, whereas larger lacunae grow in size over time. And we didn't really understand initially what's happening here, but later on we did. But I first have to explain a few other things before I can get to that point. Oh, sorry, these are contour lines,
yeah.
And those are described, those are contour lines of the chemotherapy.
Okay.
Okay. However, if you look better at the data, at the paper, you see that in these vegetarian double knockout mice, cell adhesion might not be as much effective as you would expect, because if you look at in electron micrographs, they still see very strong adhesion between these cells. But interestingly, vegetarian is also responsible for a second mechanism where for kind of conduct inhibition mechanism. So in this case, if cells are not bound by vegetarian and you have binding of VEGF, this will lead to proliferation, cell motility responses, etc. However, if vegetarian is bound and you have binding of VEGF, then the response is a survival signal and signal of non-proliferation, and this is the mechanism that's responsible for the formation of monolayers in cell culture models, for example. So we thought, it might be that indeed cells are only going to respond to this chemotractin by extending filopodia if they are not bound to other cells, or maybe even if a cell is bound to another cell, it might still be responsive to the chemotractant at the open end of the cell and not to the bound end of the cell. So we have modified the chemotaxis response accordingly. So in this case, the cells are only going to chemotact at open ends of the cells, whereas cells that are completely surrounded by cells, or even only touching other cells, are not going to chemotact. And look what happens. Now suddenly, so we removed cell adhesion over here. So it's exactly the same simulation as the first movie I showed you. Only we added this conduct inhibition of motility assumption. And indeed, you find formation of vascular networks. And again, this typical behavior of small lacunae disappearing in favor of larger lacunae.
Well,
maybe you'll cover this, but what puzzles me about this is I don't understand why you use the word chemotax, because I can understand chemoactivation, but not, I mean, it doesn't look like, I mean, they're not headed up a gradient there. They're just stimulated, they are.
They're having up a gradient.
Up to the gradient, yeah. Only to themselves.
So, so the idea of the model is that cells are containing extended philopodia, and but preferentially extended philopodia in the direction of the kind of the gradient. And as they do so, I'm going to follow by.
Can you see that in the model equations?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So let me go back to this one, because I guess I've been a bit confusing at this point. Okay. So what we're doing every time in this model, so we have this energy term and additional chemotaxis term added to this. And every time we're going to pick a random site and try to and choose a random neighbor and say that this cell will try to expand its domain into this cell. So it's as if the cell is extending it to the podium and trying to push the other cell aside. And now we're going to, so whether we are going to accept such a move or reject it will depend on the original model on the cell adhesion and on the spawning conservation. But then by adding a further energy constraint, this one, we will say, okay, let's
So is this term delta mu times C minus C prime?
Right.
That's added to the Hamilton?
It's added to the to delta H. So
so it's delta H E. Oh, so I didn't understand.
So what we're basically going to say is, so suppose the cell is trying to expand its domain into the neighboring cell.
Okay.
We're going to favor that if it's going to be up the capital rate.
Okay, so C minus C prime is bigger than zero, then that favors it.
Okay. So in this way, as over time, this will result in mutations. Okay. So initially, also, we didn't really understand what was happening here, but by starting with a different initial condition, might actually shed some light on that. And so in this case, we start instead with dispersed endothelial cells. We start with a blob of cells. And interestingly, also, these cells start sprouting and forming a vascular network. And just to show you in more detail what is happening there, I'll show it a little bit more slowly. So what you first see is this development of the gradient by secretion and decay of the chemotaxin. And then as a result, cells would try to move inward. And in doing so, the cells, they can easily push these cells aside because they are not chemotaxin attracting, because they are contact inhibited. And so basically, what you find what we think is happening is the following instability mechanism. So cells that are initially a little bit closer to the center of the cell cluster will feel a higher chemotactic force than cells that are a little bit further out from the center of the cluster, because there is a semi-Gaussian over this cluster. Yes.
I'm sorry, I thought you said before that if cells were bound to other cells, then they didn't care if there was a gradient.
It's only the surface cells that are bound to other cells. So the cells that are actually facing this extracellular matrix are still chemotaxin.
And they can chemotaxin. But how could they chemotaxin?
Yeah,
and
so
they can chemotaxin inwards.
Yeah, because they can kind of push to the
cells.
Yeah. So. But since these cells since the interior cells are not trying to move towards the center, they can be displaced, so they can be moved aside. So this will create an outward pressure force, which will act on all the outside cells. And so, as a result, cells that initially a little bit further out from the center, having a lower chemotactic force, will then be pushed outwards. So you always have a balance between these inward moving forces, these inward forces and these outward forces. And we think that this creates this instability.
But you must have some asymmetry to begin with.
Yeah, but that's because the cells initially have a random shape.
Okay.
And there's a need, if you go back, you see, there's initially some rough boundary. Yeah. Alright. But to further analyze this mechanism, what we've done is to say, okay, let's instead of shutting chemotaxis completely down at cell-cell interface, let's vary chemotaxis at cell-cell interfaces. And then characterize this fingering instability by having the following order parameter, where we say that, and where we calculate the compactness of the object. So basically what you can do is to calculate the convex hull around these clusters, which is basically kind of the tightest gift wrapping you could make around it, and calculate the area of it, and calculate the area of the object itself. And this will create a number between 0 and 1, which would tend to go to 0 for a perfectly branched object and go to 1 for a completely convex object. And so then if you slowly vary the amount of chemotaxis relative to at the cell-cell interface relative to the chemotaxis at cell-medium interface, is that, you kind of see this sharp transition from fingering behavior to compact clusters. So what this suggests is that indeed there is this kind of if cells interior to the cluster are also chemotacting towards the center, they will not allow to be displaced. They will not be displaced by the inward moving cells. And so this might explain this instability. Well, okay. To further analyze this system, and to further validate our model, we have compared it in more detail to the cell cultures, and we have done so by using osmotic pattern analysis, where we could detect branching points, and where we counted the number of branching points like this, and the number of lacunae. And if you look at how the number of branching points and the number of lacunae behaves over time, you see that you can capture this typical coarsening behavior, where you have initially very fine-grained pattern with a lot of branching points, which tends to stabilize into a much more coarse-grained pattern over time. And now if you compare these two models that I've showed you, you see that in fact, these patterns stabilize much faster. So they really quickly find a typical pattern size, and then they stay relatively constant. So we might actually still be missing something from our model. So, the model nicely reproduces vascular pattern, but the temporal behavior of the symbiotic pattern does not agree at all to our observations. So maybe we're still missing an essential element of endothelial cell behavior. But, as I've told you in the beginning, one of the first things you see in cell cultures is that these cells are, that endothelial cells are elevated. So, basically what we did, we added a further constraint to the Semmer-Potts algorithm, which will simulate this intrinsic elongation of the cells. And basically we do so by giving the cells an end. By specifying an ideal length for each of the cells and giving the cell an energy penalty if it's far away from that ideal length. We also need to do that. Well, the simplest way for the cells to do that would be to split up in two separate batches. So to do that, we also need a further constraint, which is a connectivity constraint, which kind of reflects the physical continuity of the cells. Well, we have the following parameter settings. The cells are around 100 micrometer long, corresponding to cells and cell lengths in the cell cultures. And the cell area is really large, but we have to do that in order to to get the cell sufficient thickness in the cellular pots algorithm. Okay, and now let's see what happens. So this is again the same model, which without cell elongation creates disconnected blobs, but with cell elongation, let's see what happens. So there is no cell adhesion, there's no contact inhibition of motility. So what you see now is that indeed, initially these cells start creating a very fine-grained pattern. And we see this typical coarsening behavior, but it continues much longer. And indeed, the size of the lacunae grows quickly over time. Grows slowly over time. No cell adhesion,
uh-huh.
Which is of course a wrong assumption.
No, but I just
yeah.
want to hear me.
It's just to test its magnets. There's no cell adhesion, there's no contact inhibition of motility. So there is only cell elongation and chemoattraction.
And elongation?
Cell elongation, so the cells have an elongated shape. Yeah. And they chemoattract. And now, if we do the same thing, we again characterize the number of nodes and the number of lacunae over time, then you see that indeed this model shows the same type of coarsening behavior over time as the natural system does, as the in vitro system does. So this suggests that, yeah, maybe we have captured an essential part of this pattern and mechanism. Maybe really the shape of the cells is very important. To further analyze that, we have looked at how the cell shape affects the random walks of the cells. So what you see here is a round cell, which undergoes a typical random walk, and here an elongated cell, which tends to move along its longest axis back and forth, and then very slowly when it tries to move to change direction, it has to very slowly move and change to in order to change direction. And interestingly, this is really what this is very similar to this inertia assumption that was made by again Mazzarini in their original model. So maybe what cell elongation does in this case is really giving the cell some inertia, which is not entirely similar, of course, to Newtonian inertia, but it really makes that the cells have some directional persistence. And and this is again to show that to show the effect of cell elongation. So here we have round cells, and we slowly increase the length of the cells, and with this relatively short asymmetry, the clusters elongate, and with further elongation, the clusters, these cell clusters interconnect and form a vascular pattern. This is a picture from Charles Little, which I find very interesting because it's kind of suggestive that a similar thing might be happening in actual embryos. But really, correct me if this is nonsense. What you see here, this is a normal chicken embryo. I think it's a York sac, right?
No, it's in the embryo.
Yeah.
It's intraembryonic, vascular fed.
Okay. And So what you see here is again this typical polygonal pattern of the endothelial cells. And here the individual nuclei were stained to show where the individual cells are. And now after addition of soluble VEGFR1, which kind of catches away VEGF, the cells round up, but they are still able to aggregate. They still form nice aggregates, as you can see by the nuclear stains. So this suggests that indeed in this case the cells are still chemoattractant, but because they are not elongated, and that's of course speculation, but maybe because they're not elongated, they're not organizing it into this vascular pattern. And just to show you that, although I've made the wrong assumption here that there's no cell adhesion, this is to show that, okay, we can easily add it and the pattern still looks the same. So cell adhesion seems not to be really important in this case. And also you can easily change the size of the cell and still get the same kind of pattern. So here we have we slowly increase the number of the length of the cells and decrease the number of cells.
What happened if you did cell adhesion alone instead of chemo metastasis? It seems like they should have kind of similar effects of keeping things together in a bonding, sticking to your neighbor kind of bonding your neighbor kind of behavior. Would you still get these vascular patterns?
I don't think so. I mean, what I've tried is to turn off chemotaxis completely without cell adhesion, and then they're just walking around and staying there. But as soon as you turn on chemotaxis, yeah, then. But I haven't tried cell adhesion alone. But I mean, it could be. I mean, what you see, for example, in different systems like mixed bacteria, is that indeed you can get patterning just by steric hindrance of cells. If you're interested, I can point you at some. Okay. Of course, then the next question is, well, which chemoattractant should be responsible for these cells to aggregate? And the original continuum studies assumed this would be VEGF-165 with a very high diffusion coefficient. Well, if we use such a very high diffusion coefficient with the same half-life of VEGF-165, we get really long gradients and initially correct patterning, which later breaks down into disconnected blobs. So we had to use a much smaller diffusion coefficient or very fast chemoattractant inactivation to get shorter gradients. There's not a lot of experimental evidence that indeed endothelial cells secrete VEGF. But, there could be a lot of candidates, for example, larger isoforms of VEGF, or which might be really tightly bound to the ECM, and thus the diffusion coefficient might be reduced. Or additional molecules that might act as a VEGF trap, which might increase the VEGF degradation.
In your mind, this doesn't play any role. I mean, it seems to me that in your mind, you know, if cells are moving, we don't care about this anymore.
Yeah, but what I meant in this case is that there might be some protein in the ECM that is acting as a trap of that gel, and this way reducing their diffusion coefficient or increasing their activation. So indeed, but there's indeed no interaction with the ECM.
But how they go through the ECM?
You need to talk so we can all hear what's going on. I can't hear your question.
Yeah, my question is, in your mind, what is the role of ECM? Whether they just, it's just passive, they just go through the ECM or how
okay,
they
so move? Yeah, so in the vitro model, the cells are living on top of the ECM. So here we also assume that the cells do not have to push the ECM aside or But yeah, in a three-dimensional setting in the embryo, you would have to assume that the cells either squeeze themselves through the ECM, or that they break it down by, for example, secreting proteolytic enzymes. So.
Yeah, but still, if they are on top of the ECM, they can somehow stick to the ECM, so they need to be released.
Yeah. So yeah, the idea in this model and in the in vitro model, the ECM is really a medium on top of which you sit. So they use it to as a medium to move forward. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. conclusions. So with round cells, the cell-centered computation model can reproduce in vascular patterning like the continuum model, but only if we assume context inhibition of motility or strong cell adhesion. Okay, I'm sorry for that. I forgot to get back to the cell adhesion, to the explanation for cell adhesion. So what we can do here is also use the length constraint constrain the cells to be round. And if you do so, in the cell adhesion case, the cells again aggregate into round patterns. So what I think that is happening there is that in case of the cell adhesion, the cells try to make a very high, big contact area to each other, and as a result, they elevate passively and align to each other. And that and this might, so basically the idea is that we have two mechanisms. One of them is contact inhibition related, and the other is cell shape related, either intrinsic or active cell inhibition or passive cell inhibition. The round cell model cannot reproduce the temporal behavior of vascular remodeling, but the elongated cell model also reproduces the temporal behavior of the cell. And together, chemotaxis through a secreted growth factor and cell integration seem sufficient for vascular patterning. Some acknowledgements. I did work together with James Glazer at the Biodiversity Institute in Yale University of Bloomington, and with Stuart Newman and Sergey Brodsky and Michael Goligorsky at New York Medical College. I had some discussions, Stuart Newman had some discussions about this. Inertia of the cells with Andras Tsiolok, and some of the simulation software was the